aliens and flying saucers.
This is all in a...
Hey, welcome to the 115th episode of Two Writers Slinging Yang. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a former Sports Illustrated senior writer, former ESPN columnist, and the author of multiple New York Times bestsellers. The music you're listening to is Croissants from the great MC White Owl. And this podcast is an ode to writing in all its forms, from sports writing to screenwriting to music critique and the self-help to song lyrics to whatever genre I'm thinking of. And today's episode is the ultimate departure for me because it's a medium that both fascinates me and bewilders me. Clementine Von Radix is a six-time competitor at the National Poetry Slam, the author of multiple books of poetry, and a woman who truly grasps the power of words, the impact of hyper-specific references, the value of nuance. It's not journalism, but it's journalism's second cousin on its mother's side. I love her work. I love this episode. And it's right now on Two Writers Slinging Yang.
All right, Clementine. So this is the second time we are having a conversation because we did a very, I thought, very sort of enlightening podcast episode. And then the audio somehow did not work. And I have to say, I'm sitting here. I go to your Instagram feed, and one of the things I'm looking at is a picture of your arm with a sprig of lavender tattooed onto your wrist. And it said, yeah, you wrote, when you really commit to an aesthetic and let your ex-girlfriend tattoo a sprig of lavender on your wrist. Why would you let your ex-girlfriend tattoo a sprig of lavender on your wrist? How does that happen?
It's actually a wild story. The first week I moved to Brooklyn, I was walking down the street and like looked up and someone was staring at me. And then I looked back at her and realized it was my high school girlfriend. And we live like two blocks apart from each other in Brooklyn and have like become very close friends. But she's a professional illustrator who's interested in doing, or like transitioning to, hand done tattoos. And I'm very interested in getting tattoos done by hand. So she tattooed a sprig of lavender on me. And it was just became a very queer aesthetic because lavender historically is, a means for lesbians to flag each other.
So are you saying as a 47-year-old suburban dad, I made a mistake of going to my tattoo parlor last night and getting a sprig of lavender tattooed onto my wrist as well, inspired by you?
I mean, I think it probably looks great on you. And way to be an ally.
I mean, you're from 3,000 miles away, so the odds that you spot your high school girlfriend walking down the street in Brooklyn in and of itself, kind of random, wouldn't you say?
It extremely random. We're both from a very small town in Oregon, and we hadn't spoken in 6 years. And so for the first, like 2 days after I moved to Brooklyn to see her, just on the street was wild. It was one of those things where I was like, I think we have to be friends now. I think the universe is pushing us together at this point.
All right. Now let me ask you this. So you write a ton about relationships, I don't know about pain of relationships, blah, blah, blah. Like your poetry is sort of delves in these areas very deeply. You run into an ex-girlfriend from 6 years ago on a street in Brooklyn and wind up with a sprig of lavender tattooed to your wrist. Does that not inspire you to write something about it? Or is that not crying for you to write something about it?
I think it probably will end up in a book. I'm very interested in relationships as ways of talking about much bigger emotions. I think it's a really easy way to talk about like microcosms is to talk about like interpersonal relationships. I think the thing I want to talk about with the tattoo experience though is the intimacy of like being held while a person hurts you in that way. Like it's a very slow and very painful process. And it was just very interesting as a metaphor with like a person you have a very storied history with for them to be like, holding you very tenderly while doing something that is hurtful and permanent, but ultimately like very beautiful. There's something in there, but I'm obviously still kind of sketching it out.
When people ask me like, what's it like to write a book? I always use the comparison of when I was in college, I had a girlfriend who had really, really sharp nails. And I remember one day she gave me this back scratch. And it was the best and worst back scratch at the same time because her nails were really sharp. And at the end of the night, my back was just bloody from the sharpness of her nails. But it was it was kind of a loving pain. And I always say that's right. Like writing a book, you know, and there's something you, there's something weird about the sort of juxtaposition of pain and pleasure at the same time.
And I think people tend to glorify pain, and I'm less interested in that, but I do think there is a really clear correlation between like effort and reward, and pain is often just through simply something that you have to endure. When something is painful or when something requires a lot of effort, like the reward is that much sweeter. I often think about writing a book in terms of like running a marathon or something like that, like a physical undertaking. Mm-hmm. Like the strain or the effort of it is very difficult. I just taught a workshop last week and kept trying to frame these very like difficult prompts that I was giving people as like, I understand this isn't fun and I need you to think of this as like running sprints or like strength training. Like you'll mm-hmm. be stronger and like this muscle will be there for you next time you sit down to write. But like the process of learning it is not going to be fun. It's just going to feel like effort.
That's another way I explain writing a book. Like I hate mm-hmm. 80% of writing a book. It's isolating and it's nightmarish and you're by yourself all the time and you're in your head and you're struggling mm-hmm. for words. And it's like, why do you do this? Why do you put yourself through it? Well, I'm not going to do it again. And then as soon as you're done, you want to do it again. Because 20%, whatever it is, whether it's walking into a bookstore and seeing your book or having someone walk up to you and say, I really love that, really meant something to me or whatever. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist without the 80%.
Yeah, absolutely. I do. I think in addition, like not just the external validation, which is like wonderful. And I feel like a hard lesson for me post first book was the need, like realizing that like that part doesn't exist without the writing. Is that, which maybe makes no sense, but in that, like, it feels very hard to like switch back and forth between those worlds, especially after you've like kind of done the second like good part. You know, I especially because I do spoken word. So when I go out to promote a book, it's like, you know, 40 shows in front of like big groups of people. And it's like a real performance. And to switch back and forth between that and sitting alone in my house for 6 weeks trying to get a draft out is like a real mind fuck for me.
Yeah.
I've been trying to focus on like the parts of writing that were really fun for me when I first started writing, like the joy of actually articulating something really specific in, you know, after countless attempts. Mm-hmm. I feel like for me, writing is so much about like trying to communicate something that I can't verbalize. Like it's about giving myself infinite numbers of chances to say something that I've kind of failed to be able to say in conversation. And I've been trying to reframe the frustrations around like not how truly daunting and Sisyphusian like finishing a book feels by really reveling in those moments where I do feel like I've said the thing I came here to say. It's challenging. It's like work for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. People don't get it. I mean, yeah. People don't want to, and I understand it. Like my friend who works at Deutsche Bank doesn't want to hear me whine about having to write a book about the Lakers, or they don't want to hear, oh, are you okay writing your poetry? Like nobody wants to hear that shit. But
yeah,
I feel it. I mean, there's a quote from Dorothy Parker. I hate writing. I love having written that. I think of all the time because it's just fucking torture.
I just was having a conversation with my creative partner and we're doing a lot of workshops and we have this like long conversation with all these young writers about transitioning from like writing for passion to writing for money. And a thing that I said and always say and stand by is that like, it really is just a matter of choice if you want to be a professional writer. Like a lot of my favorite writers don't write for a living and it really is a job. It really does. I don't necessarily know if I write more when I'm writing full time. I think I just spend more time really agonizing over it and also just running the business of being a writer, of trying to like keep the project of people buying my books afloat.
I want to talk some of your work. So as I told you last time, you have made me a fan. You literally doing this podcast, I've become a Clementine fan. We discussed briefly sort of the complications of writing about people in your life. And, mm-hmm. you don't want to hurt the feelings of people in your lives, you know, but you are experiencing them on a pretty regular basis. And you wrote a thing, a piece called A Bird Flew. And you wrote, when my uncle died, we held a funeral for him and four people came. He spent the last decade of his life drunk, living in a van in the Fred Meyer parking lot. But before that, he lived with my family. When I was little, he taught me how to read, how to make pancakes, that the birds in our neighborhood were doves, and how to kill them with a well-thrown rock. But with each passing year, he became more dead dove, more flightless thing, more ghost. And it goes on and on. It's freaking great. I don't know. What's the story? Why'd you write it?
That poem's very directly autobiographical. That is, like, my father's only brother lived with us growing up. And it's interesting. I have a little sister who remembers him very, very differently. And I think that's because in the 4 years between when I started making permanent memories and when she did, he really descended into a person whose priorities were drinking and very little else, drinking and getting money for drinking. And it was just this very, I don't know, it's a very important experience and formative thing for me growing up, was how much I loved this person who became an entirely different person. I think a lot about him, I think, because he always tried to make sure that I still thought of him the way that I did when I was a little kid. I think I was maybe one of the few people in his life that still thought of him as, like, a really remarkable man. Long after he had kind of descended into a really dark place. And so I just have a lot of love for this very complicated man. And he died a couple years ago. And his death, along with a couple other things, really threw my immediate family into a lot of chaos. And so a lot of that book kind of, I think, concentrates on that grief and on trying to love people fully and wholly, which means for me also acknowledging, like, the ways that they have hurt you. And I think because he was already gone, I think because so many things he had done, it was just very easy to talk about his struggles in a very plain spoken way, because towards the end of his life, he had also begun to really discuss them in the same way. But yeah, I don't know. It's, to me, that poem was kind of that person's legacy in my life, was this deeply loving force who was also kind of a lesson in, like, how many different people one person can be, you know?
When you write something like that, is there any worry that someone, you know, Clementine, what the fuck? Why are you writing about Uncle So-and-so? He died. Like, why are you,
right?
You know, does that enter your head at all?
I do. In general, I don't write about people who've been good to me. I feel like in choosing to write and choosing to write about myself, I've consented to lead a public life. But my parents did not, my sister did not, my loved ones did not. And I generally don't like to write things that paint people in an unflattering light. This poem, I think, doesn't. I think this poem is a very generous interpretation of this man. You know, it does talk about his alcoholism, but it's also written from a place of very deep love. And I think, you know, my grandmother saw it, my father saw it, his mother and his brother. And I think they both appreciated acknowledging the complicated memory.
It's a complicated thing because I've had many relatives mad at me over the years for things I've written, because your best material is right in front of you often, you know? So it's like, oh, that's really good. But my mom's not going to love that. But I don't know. That's okay. It's a toughie. I just always find that a very tough one.
It is. Definitely.
Yeah. I'm a word choice geek here. You said he spent the last decade of his life drunk, living in a van in the Fred Meyer parking lot. I had to Google Fred Meyer. I'm unfamiliar with the Fred Meyer chain of, I kind of assumed, grocery stores. Why is it important, or is it important, to say, you know, living in a van in the Fred Meyer parking lot as opposed to living in a van in a parking lot or a supermarket parking lot? Why does the specificity a Fred Meyer matter.
I love that you brought that up because my editor and I did 10 rounds over this. I think it matters because I wanted the specificity of the image, even if it meant Googling it. Grocery stores are such a great regionalism. They tell you a lot.
Totally.
I don't know. I love reading books set in the South when people talk about like going to a Piggly Wiggly. Like, I love it. Mm-hmm. I also love when people mention like their local gas station chain. It gives you a sense of place. It also gives you a sense of ownership of like declaring a place a landmark, even if because it is a landmark for you. And I think that lends gravity to setting. I've been thinking about this a lot now that I live in New York, where people do that all the time. Because they assume that like even people who don't live in New York know where things are.
Right.
Which is really like, I think, just confidence, because I don't. And as speaking as a person who just lived here, who just moved here, I don't. And I kind of love writers who apply that same gravity to their small town. I don't necessarily need to know. Like, as a reader, I don't necessarily need to know all of the details already. I can pick it up through context or through the way that the speaker refers to the thing. And I just prefer it that way. I like lending a lot of gravity and legitimacy to very small and individual stories.
I always say, like, I teach journalism, and when I'm writing, I always want to know that I need to go beyond that it was a soda. I need to know that it was a Diet Pepsi, and I need to know that it was in a bottle, not a can. And I need to know if the bottle was plastic or glass, and I need to know if it was half filled or not half filled. I need to know if it was open, if there was a lipstick stain on the. How important are the details when you're writing in this genre?
I think they're very important. I think they provide a sense of place. I think they tell you a lot about like who a person is. I really subscribe to the idea that there's a lot of humility in writing about the individual and writing about yourself as an individual and not presuming that you have any perspective other than your own when you're writing in first person, just really leaning into your own subjectivity. And I think part of that is referencing really specific details of your life. And I think the images do build into kind of their own poetry. I mean, like, speaking of, you know, in journalism, I think about that a lot in like music interviews, which I read a lot of, or different profiles. Like, I read a lot of profiles of people, and that super, super specific imagery of like what they're eating or like how they move through their living room builds an idea of who that person is for me so much more than their answer on what their latest project was. Like, it matters much more to me, like, how they talk to their assistant as they enter the room. Like, all of those things really build a much clearer version of a human being to me.
Yeah, that's a great point. If you're reading a profile of, like, Will Smith, and the interviewer points out that he's chowing down on some cornflakes and the milk is dripping off his chin, that's the thing you're going to remember from that interview.
Exactly.
It's kind of weird. Word choice. One of my favorite things that you wrote that I've read is called Patron Saint of Manic Depressives. You wrote for Vincent Van Gogh, Patron Saint of Psychotic Manic Depressives. Often I think of Vincent and the meat that once was his ear and how he gave it to a pretty girl that was not certain of his name and then spent the night alone trying not to bleed to death. And ever since my own diagnosis, some part of me is always alive. And inside that moment, I picture scared girl, the bleeding painter, the jagged flesh between them. And sometimes I am the girl. Sometimes I am the dripping blood. But most often, I'm the one offering up some unwanted mess of myself and calling it a gift. I told you this before, and I mean it. Meat is the best word. It's the best usage. If there were an Academy Award or whatever for best usage of the word meat, you win it right there. I often think of Vincent and the meat that once was his ear. Meat to me, the word meat is Subway is closing in 10 minutes. And they have some kind of little nasty looking turkey, and you decide you're really hungry, so you get the turkey sandwich, and the guy behind the counter slaps down the four last pieces of, you know, turkey, sliced turkey, and it just goes plop, and that's meat. Why would you call Vincent Van Gogh's ear the the meat that once was his ear. Like, why would you use that word?
I use that word because I really, first of all, because that poem was written to be performed, and I think it's a very, it is like a very kind of jarring, kind of gross word, and I perform, and I'm like, I'm 5'2", I'm very small, I have a very soft voice, I am very still when I perform, and I really liked the juxtaposition of me and my very soft, very like feminine voice saying meat about a person's body. I think that I think that that kind of carnage really created this beauty as the grotesque kind of juxtaposition that was really important to me as a framing to set up a poem about like how bipolar disorder is both incredibly empowering and really dark. That poem's really full of these really direct comparisons. It also says, like in the like two verses down, it's to be both violence and victim, the knife and the flesh that welcomes it in. It's a lot of comparisons between kind of a beautiful or an innocent thing and a very, very grotesque thing. And I like talking about a body part in the most kind of gross way that I could to like lead into this very delicate poem.
What is Euro? I am chaos. I'm a barely hidden bar fight. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from?
It comes from using a lot of whiskey imagery in my poems, using a lot of bar imagery. But I think I'm a person who values invulnerability. Like I really, really struggle to like let my walls down. It's like a problem. But I also have, it's, I think directly because I have this condition that makes me feel emotions incredibly intensely. And that makes me very guarded about like who I let into that kind of emotional experience. And so to talk about being chaos or a barely hidden bar fight is about feeling like a very high functioning person or a person who can move through the world seemingly without like a lot going on, who often has a lot going on. You know, I think my emotional reactions are often so intense to fairly minute things that it often does just feel like a full out brawl over, you know, how upset I am about how dinner, you know, how I fucked up dinner, you know, I burned something and all of a sudden I'm like, well, I'm clearly truly unlovable. And, I need to just really roll in that emotion for 45 minutes. I both wanted to like share that reality without like fully, letting people into it or acknowledging that like not letting people into it is part of the struggle of it. And that's where those images end up.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yay, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my son Emmett and his friend Harrell. And in honor of my sponsor, 503 Sports, kings of the throwback sports merchandise, I thought it'd be cool to have you guys read some of my Amazon reviews, just to show the people at 503 what value they're getting for this space. Emmett, you go first.
Okay. I've read about one half of this book, and I do not expect that my finishing of it will change my low estimation of it. The writing is a little above good high school writing. The analysis is thin to the point of being non-existent.
Harrell?
Was this written by a high school student? I'm very surprised to get such a badly written book from Jeff Perlman.
Emmett?
Jeff Perlman epitomizes the liberal agenda and should just stop.
Harrell?
Jeff Perlman is a... I don't think I'm allowed to say that word out loud.
Yeah, let's end this. I'll just go on and say 503-sports.com is the absolute best place for sports merchandise, and maybe stay away from Amazon, at least for a while.
You sort of write about mental illness and struggling with mental illness and at the same time, in a way, being driven by mental illness. What does that do to you as a writer? Is it the kind of thing like the almost like getting back to pleasure pain where you have this thing you have to deal with and it's really hard to deal with, and at the same time, it kind of fuels a lot of what you're writing about?
Yeah, I really feel like, and I hesitate to say this because I don't want to like glorify mental illness, but I do feel like bipolar disorder is almost like living in a poem. In a lot of ways, to me, it feels like it makes the world more poetic, because poetry to me, there's a Ann Carson quote that if writing is a house, poetry is the person on fire running through the house. And poetry is about diving endlessly into very specific emotions. And poetry is about the regular world enhanced, you know, metaphors that take the sun and turn it into a different person's imagining of the sun, you know, that feels truer because the language is less exact. And to have a mental illness that makes you occasionally see colors more vibrantly, see things that are not there but are a manifestation of something going on in your head, to see, to feel emotions very intensely. I do think those things certainly inform who I am as a writer, and have built, are kind of the basis of my artistic aesthetic. And in that way, I do think that having a mental illness has like helped or shaped who I am as an artist. That being said, until I properly addressed mental illness, my mental illness, and like sought treatment for it, I just couldn't write, you know. It's
like you literally were frozen from writing.
I couldn't finish anything. I couldn't really sit down to write when I can't when I'm not doing well. When I'm depressed, I get so paralyzed by negative emotions that I can't finish. And when I'm manic, I don't have the ability to focus and refine. I really do need, you know, it's not as though leaning into the instability of bipolar disorder makes me a better writer. Like, health and treatment made me a person who was able to be a writer. I think that, but part of that was in therapy, getting the tools to reframe my mental illness as something that does strengthen me, and being able to think of the ways that it affects my thinking that can heighten my writing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. It totally does. It does. But I just think it's a fascinating thing, because I've interviewed and known many sort of writers who struggle with mental illness, and it's almost like, I fucking hate this, but I also kind of need it.
Yeah.
And the weirdness of that.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if I need it. I certainly do think that it informs who I am, and I'm not, it's almost not useful to me to think about whether or not I need it, or to think about whether or not I'm grateful for it. It feels like thinking about whether or not I'm grateful for having brown hair, you know, like it just kind of, it's not useful. It's a fact about me, and it feels more useful to focus on how I can best navigate the world with that, rather than to philosophize on who I would be without it. Because I'll never know who I'd be without it. That's not helpful information to me. But thinking about the ways that it's informed who I am, thinking about the ways that I can better utilize it to communicate to others and to be a good writer in person, that is a really interesting question to me. And that's something that I engage with a lot.
I'm going to throw a total curveball at you. I'm going to throw something at you. We did not. Okay. Today is my daughter's 16th birthday, and it's joyful and heartbreaking at the same time. Right. Mm-hmm. Like two nights ago, I could not. So I was up at 3:30 in the morning looking through old pictures of her and sort of her on my shoulders and her in princess dresses, you know, and even now it hurts me. Like, it's a real painful hurt. And at the same time, I'm happy because I'm very proud of her, and I see her, and I love who she is, and it brings me great joy. But it's also like this profound, profound sadness, right? Mm-hmm. I'm you, right? I decide I'm going to write about this. This is what I am going to write about. What do you do? What's your process?
I would focus on those two emotions and try and figure out two things, like what specific story I'm going to use as a framing for those emotions. You know, or are you going to talk about like watching her cut a birthday cake when she was 6 and then watching her cut a birthday cake when she's 16? Or are you going to talk about, like, I think there's a lot of ways to contrast that. My second thing was going to say, what would the form of the poem be? But clearly, now that I'm talking about it even for a second, I would definitely contrast, like, her as a child versus her now. You know, her in princess dresses, her getting ready for prom, her doing this, her doing that. The interesting thing about it is there's so much love in that feeling, right? There's so much love in both of those directions, and it's about figuring out how to express that in a way that, like, moves time forward, unless you don't want to, unless what the poem is about moving it backwards. But I would start there. I don't know. I think you should write this poem.
Are you walking along and an idea pops in your head and you think, I'm going to write about that, and you rush out to get your notebook? Like, how do you do it?
In Blue Nights, Joan Didion talks about her writing process when her daughter was a child, and how she would just try and be writing to get a draft out, especially because time was so limited. She had a 9-year-old or whatever, however old her daughter was, but trying to write out a draft. And then when she couldn't think of a word or couldn't think of an image, she just put brackets and come back to it. And for me, it's a lot of that the past couple of years. I think now that it's like, I know more or less how to write. It's a lot of building a framework. And then once I have the time, going back and filling in the gaps. Occasionally, especially if I'm like deep in the editing process, which I kind of am right now on a couple poems, will just be called away before I'm ready to like leave that problem behind. And those are maybe when the big moments of inspiration still hit, or when I'm like waiting for the subway or standing in line somewhere, still thinking about the problem I like didn't want to walk away from my desk for, and something will occur to me that solves it. And those are like the frantic, does anyone have a pen kind of moments for me.
Do you need affirmation of others to feel good about a poem?
No, I don't. I don't think I have good taste in my own poetry consistently. I'm genuinely the poems that I think will do exceptionally well, and poems that I think I wrote for the views of other people, like for the eyes of other people, will just tank. And then other poems that I don't, that I really feel like I wrote for me, will do incredibly well. But that's not the rule either. There's also poems, you know, that I just generally, yeah, the poems that have ended up getting really successful have surprised me. The poem Mouthful of Forevers, which is the title poem for my first book and far and above my most popular poem, it's really taken on a life of its own. And I did not think that that poem was going to be remarkable. You know, I never posted that poem online. I never really promoted that poem at all. It was just in the middle of my first chapbook and other people started posting it online and it got a lot of attention.
All right, so Mouthful of Forever.
I am not the first person you loved. You are not the first person I've looked at with a mouthful of forevers, and we have both known loss. Like the sharp edge of a knife, both lived so long with lips more scar tissue than skin, that love arrived unnoticed in the middle of the night. Love came when we had given up on asking it to come. That has to be part of the miracle, and this is how we heal. You kiss me like forgiveness. I will hold you like your hope. Our arms will bandage. We'll press promises between us like flowers in the pages of a book. I will write sonnets to the sweat on your skin.
I mean, how could you not think this was good? Like, it's fucking beautiful. Like, what would make you think, yeah? Like, have you figured out what does it for people? Maybe that doesn't do it for yourself. Like, what drew people to that poem that now you're like, oh, I get it. Or maybe you don't get it.
I think the reason that I didn't take that poem seriously was that it had taken me so long to get the language right. Mm-hmm. And I still wasn't entirely certain I had gotten it right. I still thought it was a little bit too plain spoken. And I think there's just a very, very, very fine line between work that is plain spoken in a way you can ignore, and work that is simple and elegant and poignant in its plain spokenness. And I have trouble distinguishing when I'm doing which of those two things. With Mouthful of Forevers, the thing is, I wrote that poem about the person I was dating at the time, who is now, like the greatest. We broke up like 6 months after that poem, but she's become the most supportive and long-term friendship I've ever had. And so it makes a lot of sense to me that this poem, which was really my first attempt to write about her and what it was like to be, what it was like to meet her and to start my relationship with her, it makes sense that that's a poem that resonates with people. But at the time, I think I was so focused on what it was I was trying to say, and so kind of self-critical and aware of like the things I had kind of not quite said the way I wanted to, that I didn't think that people would pick up what I was putting down, but they did.
We've both known loss like the sharp edges of a knife. And then we've both lived with lips more scar tissue than skin. And, like the sharp edge of a knife is not an incredibly unique, you know, like people have said, right. Sharp like a knife or sharp. And then you come with like, bam, like we've lived with lips more scar tissue than skin, which I've never heard anyone say in my life. I don't know, when you're writing and you're like, all right, we've both known loss like, all right, I guess the sharp edge of a knife. Do you ever think to yourself, I don't know, that's kind of been used? Or do you think to yourself, no, that's okay, because it's such a familiar imagery that it actually works here?
I'm a big fan of cliches in general. I think pretty much every poem I have mentions like rivers or knives or like whiskey or the moon, which are just very like very small town Oregon aesthetic. And you just kind of have to like lean into that, I think. And there's times when it gets repetitive, and then you can have that as its own problem. But a thing I kind of like with working with the same metaphors is a lot of times things like that, the sharp edge of a knife and scar tissue than skin, happen really gradually without my noticing over the course of several drafts. You end up having a lot of really kind of cool and playful things like that, of different ways you can use the same image over and over and over, that end up seeming really intentional when in fact they're just instinct that is being refined over the course of rereading it several times. That's kind of how those things end up in my work, is just kind of allowing myself to write the same image from a lot of different perspectives. I learned this phrase from Megan Valley, and she learned it from somewhere else, so I'm not giving credit to the original person, but I learned from the poet Megan Valley this rule of keeping your poetry on Mars, which is basically a way to remember that you can set a poem anywhere, you can set a poem on Mars, but if the poem is set on Mars, make sure that all the images are Martian. And so you can set a poem anywhere, you can use any kind of imagery, but a way to keep a poem cohesive is to make sure all of that imagery is in conversation with each other. So if you write about knives, also writing about scar tissue is that kind of idea.
I love the phrase, you said it in all your, this is going to sound dumb, you're gonna be like, who gives a shit, but like in all your cracked perfection, like cracked perfection is great. That's great.
Thank you.
That's fucking great. I love stuff like that. That's really good. You're a six-time competitor at the National Poetry Slam. And you're very dramatic and in the best possible way, like a really sort of, you know, I watch your readings online and they're just really gripping and dramatic and cool. And But here we are talking on the phone, and you're kind of soft-spoken, and you're sort of, you know, I don't know. And, you know, like, is it a weird sort of life juxtaposition to go from sitting in an apartment or whatever, writing on a pad, to standing in front of, a you know, whatever number of people reading this sort of thing in this very public way? Is that weird?
Not anymore. But it was. I think a thing I have learned over the course of now performing for 7 years is that really anyone can be a good performer, but the trick is to just not try and be a version of yourself that you're not on stage. I think people tried to teach me how to be a good performer when I first entered SLAM, like different coaches or people who'd found a lot of success tried to teach me to be big and to be very loud and to be very animated. And I was doing terribly in SLAM when I followed that advice, which was very good advice for them. But what worked for me was to lean into my own strengths. I think what makes someone a commanding performer is just someone who you're interested in listening to. And when I go through my everyday life, I don't attract attention to myself. I don't convince people to listen to me by being very boisterous or charming. Like, I'm not interested in being like the brightest person in the room or the loudest or the person in the center. I tend to attract attention to me by being very quiet, by waiting until I have something to say, and by being being soft-spoken and waiting for people to train their eyes on me. And there's a lot of power in that, actually, in being very still and confident and simply waiting for people to listen to you and speaking quietly so that they're forced to lean in. And I think once I started using those tools that make sense for me socially, also on stage, and once I started thinking of the audience as kind of a single person I was in conversation with, that really changed my performance style dramatically. And it was only once I started doing that I started getting any success in SLAM at all.
Let me ask you the last thing. Do people in your shoes, do poets have to worry about coming off as self-indulgent? Like, is that a concern at all? Like, someone's going to be like, ugh, we get it. You're sad. We get it. Like, okay. You know, or whatever emotion. Like, is that a concern? Or are you ever listening to other poets and thinking kind of in your head, God, that's a little self-indulgent, or no?
I'm struggling with the question. I think generally when I feel like a poet is being, when I catch myself thinking a poet is being self-indulgent, I tend to, my next thought is, no, they're not being self-indulgent. It's just that the writing is not strong enough for me to be let into their head. You know, I'm interested in any poem or emotion, big or small. I think the times when it doesn't resonate with me is when there is some kind of problem with the writing that is making it very difficult to engage with. That's generally the problem. There's obviously a couple exceptions of people expressing a point of view that is objectively harmful or so. You know, I can think of a couple breakup poems from someone's point of view, where even in just describing the actions or how they're feeling about it, you're like, I'm very curious what the other party in this situation feels, because I think I'm on their side.
Right.
You know, there's been those instances, but generally, no, I think it's kind of a failure of the writing more than a problem with the feelings someone is feeling.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Well, listen, I appreciate you doing this so much. Seriously, I've become a huge admirer of your work. You know, so If nothing else, you've gained a poetry fan.
I really appreciate it.
I want to thank today's guest, Clementine Von Radix, for joining me on Two Writers Slingin' Yang. You can follow Clementine on Twitter at ClementineVR and visit her website at ClementineVonRadixPoet.com. This podcast is sponsored by 503 Sports, kings of the throwback sports merchandise. Visit the website at 503-sports.com. One can listen to Two Writers Slingin' Yang on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify, and reviews are always appreciated. Music is by the dazzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep writing.